Hey there, podcast listeners. I love using NovoPsych, which is why I'm really pleased for them to come on as a sponsor to our show. NovoPsych is the ultimate tool for administering psychological questionnaires, tracking outcomes, and informing treatment. With NovoPsych, you can easily access a wide range of evidence-based questionnaires and assessment tools. There's no more time-consuming scoring. It's all done very easily and automatically. There's over 100 psychometric tools available. NovoPsych has assessments for specific things like trauma, personality, and many other presenting issues that will really help a schema therapist understand complex presentations. What I really like is having all your client data securely stored in one place. It has really cool graphs and clear visualizations, which clients really like too. So if you're ready to enhance your practice, visit NovoPsych.com today and start your free trial.
Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to What's the Schemata. This is the dedicated destination for schema therapy and schema therapy practice. And I'm here with Mr. or Dr. Rob Brockman. Rob, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. And of course, today I want to introduce Chris as the Maharaja of Modes.
Oh, the Maharaja.
The Maharaja of Modes himself.
You're the Sultan of Schemas. You've been working on that for a while.
I've been using AI.
Looking at it.
Come on. I know you've been using it too. Okay. So just one more thing that we wanted to quickly bring up before we get started.
Is the ISST elections that are coming on. So the International Society of Schema Therapy. We've got, you know, their elections that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. If you're a member, you would have got an email.
It's election time.
Sent out to you. Yeah. Look, and myself and Rob, we are both running. I'm running for media coordinator. And Rob?
Yeah, I've been nominated as president. So that's really cool. And I really hope everyone gets out to vote. And of course, we'd love it if you felt that we were worthy of that. So. But the most important thing is you have your say, guys, get out there and vote. It's just be more of a prompt that the folks are aware.
Now, today, we're really lucky to have an old friend of ours, Michiel van der Weisswijk. Now, Michiel, we're going to call you Michiel because it's one of these Dutch names that's extremely hard to pronounce for the English speaker. So I hope I got it right.
You did an excellent job, Chris. Uh-huh. And lovely to see you guys.
So, Michiel, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself? You know, we can get to know you.
I'm a clinical psychologist and psychotherapist, supervisor in schema therapy for the Dutch Society and the ISST, and also supervisor in group therapy and in CBT. And I work in the Netherlands at Delft. You have supervision, personal therapy, do a lot of workshops, see clients individually and in group therapy, who are outpatient clients mostly.
Lovely, lovely.
We met, I think, in Delft or around that time. This is back at a conference, one of the first schema therapy conferences, I think about 2006 or 2008 or something. So, you know, you've been lucky to come to Australia once or twice or once before. But that was a while ago, but hopefully we'll be able to see you again in the future. So
definitely.
Your expertise is on authenticity. So, I mean, it'd be good to sort of get a sense for you. Like, I think most of us want to be authentic practitioners. And obviously it's quite a central component of schema therapy, you know, in terms of limited repairing. You don't want to really be phony therapist, I guess. And this is what, you know, we've all been trained. We've heard this sort of term, want to be real. What's your definition for being authentic in the schema therapy room? And, you know, can you give us a bit of insights into that?
Yeah. I think in layman terms, I would say that it's about really meaning what you say. And that doesn't mean that you have to be saying everything about yourself, because that's more about openness. But if you say no, that you really feel in your heart no. If you say yes, that you really feel in your heart yes. Instead of doing this trick, like sometimes patients give feedback on, you're just saying this because you're a therapist. Mm-hmm. You have to say that. That's a typical response of a patient where you have to think about, wow, was that really authentic or has the patient a point?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's something that we've all experienced. I mean, you know, that's a sort of a monthly occurrence for a lot of us, where we're trying to be authentic, we're trying to be real and have that kickback, you know. Absolutely.
So we're trying to get through that issue of the client feeling our sentiment, feeling our relationship, the things we talk about. Yeah. And you know, Michiel, you remind me of somebody I was doing some schema recently, and it reminds me that I often, and I don't know why I do this, but I'll often sort of stop and say, hey, you know, I want you to really listen now, what I'm going to say, like, and almost to cue it, to cue the authenticity. Like, I'm not just saying this, like, I need you to stop, right? Because, and then boom, like, you might say something like, I really don't think you deserve that at all. I really think that, I really feel that, you know? And sometimes I don't know why I do that. I think maybe I've learned over time to cue this in a certain way. But is this is the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, or what I sometimes do is first have this check in myself. You know, was I really authentic, or has the patient a point, and was I just simply tired or bored? Like, could happen with me, of course, as well. But if I think that I was genuine, authentic, I probably say something along the lines of, I feel hurt. I feel that you push me aside, or that you try to detach yourself, and that has an impact on me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that. I don't accept that. And I can give you one guarantee that if I am annoyed or irritated by you, I will say that as well. It's not that I only want to be warm to you as a kind of limited reparenting schema therapy trip.
Like a technique, yeah.
Do you see any differences between, because you do a lot of group work, is there differences between the way that you might, you know, self-disclose and be authentic in that domain versus, you know, individual? And
In group work, I think you have to be authentic about the whole group instead of on each individual. Like in individual therapy, you can open up a little bit more, you can pay more time to the relationship you have with that individual client. You perhaps can share about commonalities or what happens in the schema mode clashes in your relationship. But as a group therapist, you always have to keep in mind that you serve the group as a whole. And sure, sometimes you have to work on an individual level, but you have to think what is good for one person in the group might not be good for another person.
So you have to get a sense of that, you know, feeling at ease within the unit, safety within the unit, rather than one person being kind of, you know, challenged.
Yeah.
So I often think, Michiel, about authenticity as being yourself more, like having permission to be more of yourself, to be your real self. Maybe not all the way, like your clients are not going to know everything about you, but they get a sense of you as a person, like more of the real Rob, right? Or the real Chris and Michiel. And so, but you also mentioned openness. So how do you differentiate something like authenticity to openness? Because somehow I think, at least in my mind, those things can be conflated a little bit.
Yeah. I think what you already said, Rob, that openness is more about what you show about yourself, in the sense of, are you talking about your own personal stuff in lengthy details? That's about the amount of openness. Or are you saying something of yourself which helps the clients in their own progress? And do you do that in an authentic way? I mean, you can be very open and not being authentic. Like, I can tell my whole life history, like summing it up, like being a journalist, looking at the camera, and then talking, a very flat line. Probably then I'm not authentic.
So you could be kind of hiding behind information rather than actually just being you. And so it's these micro moments of just kind of self-disclosure, I think, is a big component. I mean, I'm interested, though, you know, what's stopping people from being more authentic? You know, I mean, we often see it, boundaries and, you know, this sort of stuff in clinical programs. And we're as trainers, are often working with that, you know, trying to uphold the boundary, but also be more real. Is it, do you think it's just people's training, or do you think there are other things at hand to stop people from being more real?
I think it's partly our training. Sometimes in a workshop, I hear a professional say, wow, you're showing this part about authenticity as a role modeling. But I've learned in my training that it's best to ask questions, not show myself, not show my irritation, just being, like they would say in Latin, a tabula rasa, a blank sheet where people can project things on, but not showing myself as a person and what I feel in the relationship. So, yes, I think it's partly training and supervision. And the other part is also that a lot of professionals in mental health care have this Superman, Superwoman syndrome, being very healthy, wanting to save people.
Super professional.
Super professional.
Got it all together.
Exactly. I've got it all together. I knew this.
Fine.
Yeah, I had this problem a couple of years ago, but now I don't have this problem anymore.
Yeah.
And then you're moving out of the authenticity and openness. And I think a lot of us are also...
So these modes, right, these Superman, Superwoman modes are a kind of threat to authenticity in the therapy relationship.
Definitely.
There's a lot around feeling professional as well. I kind of see, you know, trying to, you know, highlight the point, you can still be real but not and be professional. I mean, hopefully you can see from the way that Rob and me act and, you know, I'm sure the way you act with your colleagues, you know, there's a kind of a realness list. I hope that's the case. But there's a professionalism, you know. I mean, have you got anything to say in regards to that, feeling that concern? No.
Not sure what you
I think, you know, have you got anything to say about, you know, the concern if I was if I was a supervisee going, oh, I don't feel like that's very professional. You know, what's your comeback around that? How do you respond to that?
I probably would say something if I would feel that way, like I feel being hurt, because the fact I might do it different from the way you're doing it doesn't mean that I'm not professionally working. And also the realization that a lot of us find it very difficult to be open and authentic. So that's something to mention as well. You know, I realized that we live in a professional culture where the only professionalism is when we use the right techniques. That is where we're rated on, and that we have to be warm and have to show limited rebounding.
But you can do it right.
Exactly. You have to do it right. You have
pressure
to get this score.
Yeah.
4.5.
Exactly.
So, okay, like, authenticity, and I guess a question that I have is, do you have some specific examples around how, you know, deepening the authenticity or having quite a focus on that might have led to, you know, to certain breakthroughs in a therapy context, or, you know, how it works sometimes?
Yeah. Well, not going into specifics on certain clients, but in general, what I've learned, for instance, when patients are automutilating each other or themselves.
Or themselves, or, maybe.
Yeah, themselves.
Yeah.
or suicidal, it's good to share and show irritations when you have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While in generally, I've always learned in my training, it was more about asking questions. Why are you doing this? To what is it related? Can you tell me more? Do you have specific plans? Oh, I feel sorry for you. But once in a while, there comes a time that you think, not again. Stop with this. And do you know what you do in relationship to me? And sharing that, and actually, in some cases, even being pissed off, was so opening up the patient, saying, you know, that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to hurt you. And they start to get out of their bubble, out of their detachment. And some even saying, you could have said this earlier. That would have been okay. That wouldn't have been a problem. And when I was doing this the first couple of times, I thought, wow, okay. But this is so different from what I've learned.
Yeah. You think the sentiment is when you're not perfect, you know, when you're not real and authentic, what do you think the experience for the client is? If you can,
They stay more in their bubble because by nature they feel hurt, they feel detached, they're in a bad place. So there is no reality check. They're less concerned with other people because of the state they're in. That's logical. So they need to have awakening up. They need to feel you. And of course, if you're asking these questions, especially in the beginning, when you don't know the patient good enough, it feels like, this therapist is having interest in me and is asking me questions what other people don't dare to do.
It's like you actually matter.
For the fifth time.
I mean, am I right in feeling like you actually do matter rather than
if you're
just
irritated,
going through the risk assessment?
If you're irritated or if you have a reaction, it means
irritated
that
because you care about the person, you're trying to help them as opposed to just focusing. I get the sense that's what, you know, the experience I think at clients will say, well, it actually feels like, you know, I matter to you when you kind of, you know, confront me or deal with me in this way. You know, it's not just a tick a box exercise.
And what I'm hearing too, guys, I mean, Michiel, is that to some degree, when we tick the boxes or we play a role, it can just feel very automatic and right. They've seen this before, and it's more conducive to like a detached protector for the client. And so maybe they experience us as a bit detached as well. And we both stay in the bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. Which in a sense we are, because one of the first things you see in peer supervision is that people say, do you have a crisis plan made up with your client? And did you check whether the patient is following the crisis plan?
It's funny when we talk about this, because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, talk about AI and, you know, therapists being replaced by AI. I think it's going to be quite interesting for a self-aware, authentic AI practitioner to respond this way.
AI is like, I'm pissed with you right now.
Yeah. I have feelings too. No, you don't.
Yeah. No, something you don't.
You remind me of a couple of things, Michiel, like as you talk about authenticity. One of the things is that sometimes, like, it does actually hurt a little bit when you're really trying to reach a client about, you know, in the reparenting, and they say this, you know, wow, you know, I don't believe it, or, you know, I hear it, but I don't believe it, or you're in a role. And I guess I feel like sort of often saying, wow, like, so on some level, it's like you don't trust me on this. you know, when I say this to you in earnest, well, you find it hard to believe this, at least, at the very least, you find it hard to believe, you know, so it's a kind of trust thing.
Yeah.
We mentioned before about the reasons why people wouldn't be too open, and I'm just thinking in terms of particular schemas and modes that would disincentivize or kind of respond. Have you got anything to say about that? Like in terms of like, you know, if you've got a particular therapist with particular mode that they might be in or particular schemas that might lead to less authenticity?
Yeah, I've done research on people, professionals who have done personal therapy as part of their job training. One of the requirements in the Netherlands is, for instance, when you become psychotherapist or clinical psychologist, that you have to have 50 sessions of personal therapy. And typical profiles for therapists is having a low vulnerable child part, having a very high healthy adult, a high happy child. And that's a real latent profile. So they're interconnected. And you typically get responses when you say, okay, but where is your vulnerable part? How can I feel that part? Oh, you know, I've learned so much in my life already. I don't feel so easily more hurt.
Wow.
And if I am, I can cope quite well with it. So I think that's for the mode part. For the schemas, it's probably more about emotional inhibition. However, that's not their main schemas. The main schemas are self-sacrifice, unrelenting standards, and sometimes emotional deprivation.
Yeah.
I completely agree. You can understand, I don't want to be real with you because I don't want to hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
And unrelenting standards is probably the professional thing of like, I'm a professional, I'm, you know, I need to project. And, you know, if I self-disclose, I'm looking incompetent or looking like a bozo, you know, this sort of stuff. I mean, is that what you're thinking in terms of?
Yeah.
Mikhail, we run these self-practice, self-reflection retreats, usually once a year, either in the Blue Mountains of Sydney or sometimes in Bali. And what I find working with schema therapists is that there's this surface, you know, what are the schemas? Oh yeah, I have unrelenting standards. I have self-sacrifice, right? But the question is, these are conditional schemas, aren't they? So actually there has to be something underneath, right? In most occasions. And I think you're exactly right. When we do this with schema therapists in Australia, these retreats, 9 times out of 10, we end up with a wall of emotional deprivation, right, as the primary schema that's driving these things. And so many folks that felt either parentified or that no one was there, or the big one that no one understands me. No one really was there to get me. So I completely agree with that analysis. It's what I've been finding as well. Yeah.
I think already the way you're presenting it, Rob, like, yeah, I have this unrelenting standard. And the self-sacrifice.
That's exactly how it presents.
Shows what
is it socially acceptable.
Underneath.
They're more socially acceptable.
Yeah. And there's almost a pride. Like they say, oh,
pride,
you got me. You got me. Yeah. Guilty is charged. Guilty is charged. I'm a perfectionist. I'm a self-sacrificer. And actually, the data you talk about, it makes me think for sure, actually, that this is a demand characteristic. Like when you say, oh, you know, the therapists say I have a lot of healthy adult and no vulnerable child and all these things. That's not my experience. Like when you get into the therapy, or not the therapy relationship, the supervision relationship with therapists, actually, there are a lot of vulnerabilities. I think to some degree that the idea of the wounded healer is a kind of truism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely true. I think 60% of the therapists we've seen for personal therapy have had a major life event. Either they had to take care of a parent, or they had a brother or a sister with an illness and they had to be the good child. So there's a lot of parentification amongst the therapists. There's a lot of hurt therapists, wounded therapists.
I have a little theory about this, Mikhail. I can bounce it on you. So, okay, 90% of therapists have emotional deprivation of some description. And so what happens, right? Growing up, they feel alone, they feel misunderstood, no one's caring, no one's getting them. Okay. So what do? We go and study for 6 or 12 years and we overcompensate. We want to know all the theories and all the techniques so that everyone can be understood and no one has to feel like this again. Or maybe that's just me.
It must be resonated with me. Hey, just to be devil's advocate, and I think, you know, obviously, when does the line in terms of boundaries and too much openness, how would you differentiate that? I mean, there's ways that we could communicate, but I'm always interested in understanding from yourself. Like, when can it be counterproductive? When do we know that the openness is good for the client? Like, what's your thoughts around that?
I think it's good to have this rule in mind. You don't want the patient to go through a parentification in your relationship. However, that's also a rule which can inhibit you from being open and authentic. So it has two sides. In general, I think you have to start exploring by being a little bit open. I think authenticity is always good, but being open and the amount of openness, that's something you have to explore and to see what works with one particular patient.
And because sometimes it can be a bit blunt, or you could be, you know, you can be open, I'm authentic with you, but you're pissing
me
off.
I'm just going to say it. I just tell you like it is. Yeah. Is there a problem if I tell you the truth? Yeah, it's the truth, isn't it?
This is my reality. Take it or leave it.
Like a Donald Trump type style.
Yeah.
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 So he's very open, high openness, very low authenticity.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Because what you expect, if you would do it like that, you need to be able to take in the feedback of your client. So when the client is saying to you, well, you're more a dictator, you have to be able to reflect upon it. And even if that wasn't your intention, you should be able to genuinely say, this wasn't my intention, but getting your feedback, I made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, even so, owning mistakes, you know, that you might have overshot the runway and said something that you didn't mean. That's very, very.
So this can be very powerful sometimes when it's appropriate to apologize, to say sorry for things if you really feel it. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly, and not as part of a trick because you don't like the angriness of the patient and want to stush it a little bit. No, sorry. Didn't want to hurt you.
It reminds me of an old friend of mine who, you know, if we ever asked him something, he would always go, yeah, nah, definitely. And the translation would be, there's no way I'm doing that. You know, and I think for him, it was, you know, just very compliant and avoiding conflict. And it's, you know, it's this idea of just we have to stop and notice and take.
So this stuff. Focus on authenticity, I think it can be very hot. Like a very hot technique or provocative in a way. No? That, and it reminds me a little bit, you know, I don't know if you've heard, we were at a workshop with Remco van der Vinyard maybe earlier this year. And he was talking about doing empathic confrontation with clients and how sometimes he does it a different way around where he'll do the confrontation first and then he'll lay on the empathy. Right.
Yeah.
And he fits that in like a window of tolerance idea. Have you seen that before?
Yeah. Well, it's similar with my ideas about it.
Yeah.
So recognize it straight away.
Yeah. So he lays it on. Sometimes he'll do the confrontation first and it's quite provocative and it's quite experiential. And for people that might be very, you know, under aroused or detached as a way of sort of activating things, bringing the session to life. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes even when patients are too aroused, you sometimes have to do the confrontation first. You have to say, stop, instead of, I know where you're coming from. I know where that you feel hurt, but I still want to stop you. If patients are too aroused,
right,
you
right.
have to meet them at
just,
their
just
level.
A quick, like, yeah, yeah, okay, we have to calm down, we have to, yeah, something like this, especially with anger, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, makes sense, makes sense.
What kind of practical applications or tools or ideas can we suggest to the therapists that are listening that might cultivate more authenticity in their work? Do you have any ideas?
How do you help therapists be more authentic?
How do you teach? Manualize this?
How do we teach this? Give me a step-by-step.
Step-by-step instruction.
It's the step-by-step approach.
The McKeel step-by-step, yeah.
Well, I think step one is first that we have to learn, what have we learned and is this okay? Isn't this all about techniques? So in my workshop, I always mention, you know, it's great to learn techniques, but in the end, it's also about, are you genuine? Are you a real person being a professionalist? That's the first question you have to ask yourself. The second one is, what is my life history? What have I learned? How are my schemas? How are my modes? And what am I willing to share with clients? Because it's so helpful to think about what am I willing to share and what am I not willing to share. It makes it easier to be authentic. And the other thing is do. Simply do and make mistakes and own up.
Yep.
In terms of the discussion about your own disclosure about your own schemas, for example, what's your maybe speak to that? Like, what differentiates what to talk about and what not to talk about? You think, what's your feel?
Well, I personally do not talk so much about schemas and modes, my schemas and modes, because I think the risk of that is intellectualizing the conversation with the client. So sure, it's easy to say, you know, I've got a demanding parent and that's why I'm doing a lot of things with work and in the evenings, but that's also a kind of detachment. So I prefer to talk more about what do I feel in the relationship, or perhaps depending on the patient, of course, what fits and doesn't fit, share something of my personal life without going into too much disclosure. So, for instance, and of course, I've reflected upon this before talking it to you guys, when a patient is wrestling with, will I have kids or won't I have kids? I tell something about the problematic part my wife and I were having around having kids, or when it's related to the death of a parent in early years, I tell something about my loss of my father when I was 13, but not with all cases, only when I think it's applicable.
Yeah. Very strategic.
In a lot of cases, I don't talk about it.
In quite a strategic way, like you're reflecting about it. It's not impulsive on most occasions. It's something you're thinking about. Should I? Is this going to be therapeutic?
Exactly. Exactly.
Another thing.
Actually, the same way I'm saying it now. I'm just in my mind at the same time looking what feels okay and what not. Where do I feel too much hurt? Because then I'm not going to share it. Yeah. I have to be in this professional balance.
One of our colleagues in Perth, Chris Hepworth, he talks about, you know, he uses it when we do training together. He talks about, you know, want to disclose from the scar, not the wound. So if obviously if there's something that's going on for you, if you're in a messy divorce, you're talking to someone and they're in a divorce too, that's kind of a bit too scar-like. But if you were divorced 10 years ago and you knew that pain, then maybe being real about, look, I've been there, I've been through a messy divorce and it's really painful and it's going to get easier. Yeah. That would be a really powerful
thing.
That's a nice little comment.
So, McKeel, we've been focusing a lot on authenticity. This is something you've been actually thinking a lot about. So we wanted to talk to you about that. But I do wonder if there's anything else going on in your professional life, in I know you're quite a strong researcher and doing a lot of publications and research and other things in practice. Is there anything else that we should hear about from you?
Well, something which you already mentioned is AI, the use of AI in schema therapy.
Right. Well, we're on to
something. All right, let's do this.
I'm actually trying it out in a day treatment program, but also with some individual clients to let them practice with AI as a kind of assistant, saying, of course, okay, AI can't be authentic. Yes, it's still the best to meet with people. Mm-hmm. And AI means that you always have to look about, am I still the owner or am I just simply doing what AI is suggesting? But for instance, I explain to patients and let them practice with it when you are far out of your windows of tolerance and you're trying to get a grasp of what is going on in this situation, what schemas and modes have been triggered, and how can I get back into my healthy adult side, then AI is a lovely tool just to have a moment of reflection. Just type in the situation, ask, for instance, ChatGPT, ask it, if you follow the schema therapy model, what schemas and modes are triggered and how are the ways to get back into my healthy adult? And it gives a very
responses.
Is that right? Is that these are the prompts?
Because Rob and me were playing around with it and we were going, if we were doing an imagery exercise and you were playing a role of a client, can you do a role play with us as an exercise? And it would do it.
So what I figured out is that if you try to get therapy from AI, from ChatGPT, it says it has a prompt and it says, sorry, I can't provide mental health services, but that you can trick it into giving you therapy by saying, could we do a role play? And I want to learn how to do this. If I was pretending to be a client, I have PTSD, memories, trauma. Can we do imagery scripting? Then it will do it.
Yeah. And for instance, you can say, I've got the schema social isolation, and I want to change the patterns which come from that part. Could you give me exercises how to work on it?
Wow.
And it gives a beautiful list on what to do.
Beautiful, beautiful. Do you have a list of prompts, like your favorite prompts in this space?
Well, actually, the two I was mentioning, so you can ask, okay, I've got this schema or this mode. Do you have suggestions how I can break through the old patterns? Could you give me exercises?
Nice.
That would be one. Mm-hmm. Another one would be, this is the following situation. Can you think with me from a schema therapy model about which schemas and modes are triggered here and what would be a healthy adult response taking care of my vulnerable child?
Wow.
Wow.
The key thing is to give it information. The more information is the better. Sounds.
We were playing around with this a little bit last year, and I found that it on most occasions, it almost always gave the part of the solution was to do mindfulness. It was like a standard thing. Like as soon as you're activated, you practice mindfulness or something like this.
Is there any other new trends that you see emerging in the next 5 to 10 years, other than AI? You've been evolving.
Where are we headed in schema land?
Yeah.
Where are things headed?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to, what are the right amounts of sessions for patients and what works for whom? And we have to do that because of the enormous waiting list worldwide. The loss of enough therapists for all the patients there are. Originally, we always thought, of course, everybody needs long-term therapy. And I'm not sure if that's correct. Mm-hmm. But also works individual therapy for that patient better or group therapy for that patient better. And what I hope that we don't do is to create more modes and more schemas. Let's stop with that. Let's think more about profiles. Let's simplify it. Make it easier for patients and therapists.
Yeah, well, I was doing a list the other day. You know, Dave Edwards' paper where he did a review of all the modes, you know, the case conceptualization. It's a lovely paper and a beautiful way to bring it together. But I was counting them up for a presentation I was doing, and it's 84 modes, right, in that paper that are proposed in various papers. Look, I've got one thing, Michiel, though, going along with this theme of finding the profiles and maybe finding out like how brief schema therapy can be. I did become aware about a month ago, there's a Dutch study. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. It came out and they applied schema therapy in a much briefer format. And also they dropped the cognitive techniques. So they had no cognitive techniques, and it was more a focus on the experiential stuff, straight up bang. And I think I'm going off memory right now, it was like 12 to 14 sessions, and they had significant results in 12 to 14 sessions of a more intensive version of schema therapy with no cognitive techniques in there. Are you aware of this study? Have you seen this one?
No, not this one. No.
Okay.
But I think there are a couple of things. We have been very much focused in research on that personality disorders completely had to change, had to disappear. Instead of, for instance, asking clients, what is it that you want to get out of therapy? Where are you now? Where do you want to be at the end? So less focusing on the degrees of symptoms.
Yeah.
Then, for instance, I can imagine you get a good result in 12 sessions if it fits with what the patient is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I think you could drop the experiential techniques and just do the CBT techniques as well. Not saying that I'm a CBT fan, but more saying that I don't think that it matters which technique you use when you have a focus. When you work a lot with what is happening in the relationship inside and outside therapy. For instance, in one of my studies, we compared CBT groups with experiential groups with day treatment. And of course, it wasn't an RCT, but we didn't find any difference.
Mm.
And actually, the CBT group was more severe than the experiential group.
Yeah.
There are a lot of comments to think about it, of course, but it always reflects to me that I think, are these techniques really so important?
There's also something about, you know, the techniques and also the limit, the time limit. But there, I think there's something about, like, you know, you mentioned this a couple of, you know, this recent study and in other situations, time-limited intervention. There's something about saying to a client, whether it's 100 sessions or, you know, 13 sessions, you've got this.
Sometimes, like when there's just a few sessions left, you get all of this, oh, we have to do it, right? We have to change now as a pressure. Let's not waste time.
It's this pressure cooking pan, which you actively use in a time-limited therapy format, and which you do not use so much in a 100-session format. Not saying, of course, that there aren't patients who need this 100 sessions. I think a lot of patients do need that.
Yeah. Can you guys see this now? I'm just flashing up on the screen. This is the paper. Do you know Rowena Van Vermeer?
Yeah.
And Samantha Bormeester and Annemieke Starenberg. So this is the paper. In fact, it actually is a little, it's not super, super new. I can see now it was published maybe a year ago. This is the one. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They had a brief format, and they dropped the cognitive techniques, and they found quite large effect sizes for a brief version of schema therapy in outpatients with cluster C. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah. So well done to those guys. And maybe this is the kind of research that we'll see more of.
Yeah, and Rob, actually, they've used my protocol, and now I see it.
Yeah, you can see.
Sessions experiential.
Is this your protocol?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's cool.
That's cool.
So you've been playing around with the protocol a little bit, because the original Cluster C protocol was like 1 to 2 years, I think, right? Maybe 1 year weekly and then another year with maybe monthly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Wow. Mikhail, it's been absolutely lovely hearing about your work and the way that you've been deepening things in the domain of limited reparenting and authenticity and the relationship. Certainly enlightened me, you know, and to sort of start reflecting on some of this stuff and seeing what I can integrate as well. So it's been very stimulating. We thank you for coming aboard and also hearing about some of the science aspects. So thanks for coming on board, Mikhail. I really hope to catch up with you at some stage. I know this is our first meeting. I know you guys have known each other since 2001 or something like that. But yeah, would you be coming to Greece in the next ISST conference?
I have to check my diary on that. Not planned it yet.
It's a little while away.
He's being real about that commitment.
Yeah. Exactly. You're being real at this moment.
We have had discussions as well, possibly you coming to Australia. So, yeah, we will keep those discussions and hopefully that will happen. But look, you'll think.
Yeah. Hopefully we see you soon enough. And exactly. All right. So see you guys. I hope to see you soon, Mikhail. Take care.
See you soon.
Thank you for having me, guys.